It is 10 o'clock, and my name is Ellie Miller, and I am pitch hitting for Janice, who's on vacation. So it probably may be a shorter meeting. Who knows? I have lots of information, though, to cover. And we're going to start off with Marty, who's going to tell us about the emotional support group. Marty,
There
okay.
we go. All right. Sorry. Had to unmute there. Okay. So let me just toss something into the chat real fast. Okay. There it is. All right. So thank you very much, Allie. So, how well we all know the traumas inflicted by the registry on ourselves and our loved ones: bullying, isolation, loneliness, loss of family and friends, struggling to secure work and housing. Life can be difficult for every person affected. That's why Axol runs emotional support group meetings every week. Our next meetings will be on Thursday and 1 week from today. And these groups are not just for registrants, by the way. Our loved ones, our supporters are certainly welcome to attend too. Every Thursday evening, Axol board member Sherry Moreno runs the group beginning at 6:30 Pacific, 9:30 Eastern. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, licensed therapist Alex Gittinger leads the Saturday afternoon meeting. The time, 3 o'clock Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern. Please note that Alex is, just like Janice, on a much deserved vacation this coming week, so I will take the reins with a few other seasoned regulars for this one time this coming Saturday. At every meeting, we do have a community here for each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant. Do not look for trolls, bullies, law enforcement, or haters. You won't find them in our meetings. So how can you participate in these wonderful groups? You can see the information that I just posted. I will post it again later on in this meeting. If you don't have access to the chat, you can always click on the emotional support group link on the Axol homepage and follow the directions. And I promise, after participating in the Axol emotional support groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. One final anecdote. We are not the only marginalized community in a hateful society. In fact, I'd rather be a registrant at an Axol emotional support group meeting with caring friends than 19-year-old trans choir singer Juniper Blessing, a victim of anti-LGBTQ hate on the cusp of Pride Month. Stay strong, everyone, but please stay safe too. And if you need emotional support, you know where you can find it. Back to you, Ellie.
Marty. So I want to also introduce Roger and Rick. They are on the board of the Family Safety Foundation, and they're going to help me navigate the meeting. And for those of you who don't know my background, I'll give you a little introduction of myself. I was born in Northwest Pennsylvania, that is now known as the Rust Belt. And I was in college, majored in special education, so I taught handicapped children and adults. Eventually moved to San Francisco, and 5 years after I moved to San Francisco, I went to law school. And when I finished law school, I moved to Los Angeles, and I became a public defender in LA County, where I was there for over 19 years. Tried a lot of cases, from petty thefts to murders. And when I retired from the county, I then worked for Greg Boyle, Father Greg Boyle at Homeboy Industries. And I worked for a couple of other nonprofits that did post-conviction work. I started a post-conviction clinic at Loyola Law School, retired from that in December of 2024. And now I just teach a class in sentencing law in Loyola. So criminal law is my area of expertise, and also post-conviction. So that's a little rundown of my background for those of you who didn't know me. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. I'm currently the president of the Axol board. And the first thing I want to talk about is that there is going to be an in-person meeting June 2nd in Pasadena, California. And Janice will be here and lead the meeting. It is at the Flint Ridge Center, which is off the 210 freeway at Mountain. And the meeting's free. It'll start at 10 o'clock and run through noon. It's a great meeting in person because, as these Zoom meetings, Janice talks a lot about the difficulties that registrants face, and being in person, it's a nice way to network. And Pastor Ron, yes, I'll put my contact information in the chat. So that's June 2nd. It's a Saturday in Pasadena at the Flint Ridge Center. The next item on the agenda that I want to talk about is the Axol Conference. It is tentatively scheduled for October 2nd and October October 3rd. However, there may be some changes. So don't book your flights, don't make your hotel reservations yet because it may change. Janice and Roger participated in a lobby day for legal services for prisoners with children. That is a nonprofit agency that is based in Oakland, California, and they combined their conference with Lobby Day. So Janice is going to look into that to see if that's something we can do. There's a few issues she needs to resolve, but if that happens, that Axol combines Lobby Day with the conference, it'll be in February of 2027, and it'll be on a weekend. So that is on hold. I'm going to talk about pending lawsuits, and I'm just going to be real brief in regard to this. Janice filed a lawsuit in Fresno, and I think she's mentioned this before, in regard to Fresno wants to prohibit housing for registrants in certain areas, and it violates state law. I believe there's a settlement conference in July on July 1st, so that's still a couple months away. And I believe Janice is also revisiting a challenge to the California Department of Corrections and their provisions for the counseling and therapy programs like Open Door or what's the other one? Sharper Future. And apparently CDCR isn't following the regulations they said they would. So perhaps on June 2nd in the in-person meeting and the next Axol Zoom meeting in June, Janice will discuss that further. One of the issues that Janice talks about is Smith versus Doe. And Smith versus Doe was a United States Supreme Court case brought by registrants in Alaska, and it had two issues. One issue is that the registration requirement that Alaska put in place came way after some of the plaintiffs were convicted. And they argued that the law happened after they were convicted, so it should not apply to them. It was a issue called ex post facto. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, sorry, there's no problem here. You have to register. The second item in Smith versus Doe was that the plaintiff said registration is punitive. And the court said, no, it's not punitive. It is just establishing a civil regulatory scheme. So the act is non-punitive. So on those two issues, the plaintiffs in Alaska lost. What I don't think we discuss enough is the dissents that were issued in that opinion. One of the dissents was by former Justice David Souter, who I believe was retired from the Supreme Court, and I believe he passed away. The other dissent is by the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who we all loved. She was a champion of civil rights. And Smith versus Doe came out in 2003. And if you recall, Janice now goes to Washington and leads a vigil, and their mantra is Smith versus Doe must go. And I think when I'm going to read a part of the dissents by Justice Souter and Justice Ginsburg, that there's hope. And I think there's hope for Smith versus Doe to be challenged in the future. Maybe not in my lifetime, but maybe in some of your lifetimes. And what Justice Souter said in his dissent is that the fact that the act uses past crime as a touchstone, probably sweeping in a significant number of people who pose no real threat to the community, serves to feed suspicion that something more than regulation of safety is going on. When a legislature uses prior convictions to impose burdens that outpace the law's stated civil aims, there is room for serious argument that the ulterior motive is to revisit past crimes, not prevent future ones. That argument can claim support, too, from the severity of the burdens imposed. Widespread dissemination of offenders' names, photographs, addresses, and criminal history serves not only to inform the public, but also to humiliate humiliate and ostracize the convicts. It thus bears some resemblance to shaming punishments that were used earlier in our history to disable offenders from living normally in the community. I think that if other future justices on the Supreme Court take note of that and other district courts, that should give everybody some hope that perhaps it can be changed. This is the dissent that Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote. And just to let you know, it was Justice Anthony Kennedy who wrote the opinion in Smith versus Doe, but Souter and Ginsburg dissented. And this is part of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent. What ultimately tips the balance for me is the act's excessiveness in relation to its non-punitive purpose. As respondents concede, the act has a legitimate civil purpose to promote public safety by alerting the public to potentially recidivist sex offenders in the community. But its scope notably exceeds this purpose. The act applies to all convicted sex offenders without regard to their future dangerousness. And duration of the reporting requirement is keyed not to any determination of a particular offender's risk of reoffending, but to whether the offense of conviction qualified as aggravated. The reporting requirements themselves are exorbitant. The act requires aggravated offenders to engage in perpetual quarterly reporting, even if their personal information has not changed. And meriting heaviest weight in my judgment, the act makes no provision whatever for the possibility of rehabilitation. Offenders cannot shorten their registration or notification period, even on the clearest demonstration of rehabilitation or conclusive proof of physical incapacitation. However plain it may be that a former sex offender currently poses no threat of recidivism, he will remain subject to long-term monitoring and inescapable humiliation. So there you go. If you ever want to educate somebody on why registration does not work, those are two sense that give you some information to fight the battle. Any questions from anybody so far? All right, Roger, keep an eye if there's any question. The other
Person was
case that
asking me if I can give your contact email. Can I
Oh,
put your
sure.
email? Okay.
Sure. Another case is in a district court from 2016, and it is called Does 1 through 5 versus Snyder. And it was registered sex offenders who brought an action challenging the constitutionality of the Michigan Sex Offenders Registration Act. And I know some of you are in other states, not in California. So I tried to find other cases that is in regard to registration. What this court said was sex offenders are forced to tailor much of their lives around these school zones. And as the record demonstrates, they often have great difficulty in finding a place where they may legally live or work. Some jobs that require traveling from job site to job site are rendered basically unavailable since work will surely take place within a school zone at some point. The registration requirements also resemble traditional shaming punishments. Unlike the law in Smith versus Doe, which we published information that was already publicly available, the Michigan Registration Act ascribes and publishes tier classification corresponding to the state's estimation of present dangerousness without providing for any individualized assessment. These designations are unappealable. So there you go, that the Michigan District Court talked about how registrants face designations that are done by somebody without any individualized assessment. And that's a 2016 case from District Court in Michigan. So if some of you have attended these meetings with Janice in the past, there is a phrase called frightening and high risk of recidivism. And for those who know about Catherine Carpenter, who is an esteemed member of the AXSAW board, she was president before I was. She taught at Southwestern Law School, and her research is dedicated to the registration and registration that does not work. The phrase frightening and high came from another U.S. Supreme Court called McCune, and that's McKUNE versus Lyle, Lille. It's a 2002 case. And this is what the U.S. Supreme Court said. Sex offenders are a th serious threat in their nation, in this nation. The critical first step in the Kansas sex abuse treatment program, and this is probably a case that originated in Kansas, therefore, is acceptance of responsibility for past offenses. This gives inmates a basis to understand why they are being punished and to identify the traits that cause such a frightening and high risk of recidivism. We all know that the risk of recidivism for people on the registry is low. And so what the court said in 2002 is BS. So if you want to read Catherine's article that talks about the fallacy of frightening and high, I believe it's on the Askol website. And Roger, correct me if I'm wrong, but Catherine has written some great articles about how research supports the fact that recidivism is not high among registrants, and the research that the courts rely on to make such opinions like McCune versus Lyle is inaccurate and has no basis. It's what we call junk science. And I think Janice has talked about the respondents in Smith versus Doe using junk science out of an article out of Psychology Today. It's junk science. One more case that I want to talk about is out of Colorado. And it was reversed, but it was reversed because the entire district court is going to take a closer look. And this is called the cases Millard, Millard versus Rankin. It's out of Colorado, and it's a 2017 case. The registration requirements imposed by the SORA, their Sex Offender Registry Act, coupled with the actual and potential effects of being required to register, are not merely akin to historical punishments. As shown by the evidence in this case, the requirements as applied to plaintiffs subject them to additional punishment beyond their sentences through pervasive misuse and dissemination of information published by the Colorado board. Defendant has offered no evidence that any plaintiff presents an objective threat to society, such as a material risk of recidivism. Yet plaintiffs have been and continue to be subjected to actual and potential dangers of ostracism and shaming, effective banishment and shunning in the form of limitations on their abilities to live and work without fear of arbitrary and capricious eviction, harassment, job relocation and/or firing, significant restriction on familial association, and actual and potential physical and mental abuse by members of the public who, for whatever reason, become aware of their status as a registered sex offender. They are also subject to exposure by local law enforcement agencies making checks of their residences, as happened with Mr. Millard. This case in Colorado, even though it was reversed, brings some hope that other courts in the United States are realizing that registration is punishment. And if I run another meeting, I'm going to probably talk more about what other states are doing. And when it talks about the last sentence, they are also subject to exposure by local law enforcement agencies making checks of their residences, as happened with Mr. Millard. What the police agency did to Mr. Millard is that they called him and said, "We're going to make a check of your residence." And he said, "I'm not going to be home. I'm going to be home after 6 o'clock." Well, what the police did is that before 6 o'clock, they went to Mr. Millard's house and posted a notice on their door, making it public that he is a registrant. And even though he told them that he wasn't going to be home, they didn't care. And so it was a notice that was large enough for his neighbors to see that identified him as a registrant. So anyway, I'm going to try to compile a list of other cases. And I know somebody in the chat talked about Pennsylvania, my home state. And eventually I am going to try to find that case and other cases where the local courts, the state courts, district courts are trying to show that the registration is punishment. Anyway, so far, so good.
Ellie, did you see that Ron's hand is up?
No, I'm sorry. Ron, take it away.
That's okay. I just wanted to mention, you were talking about that quote-unquote frighteningly high. That quote, in case you're unaware, came from Collie Lee Daniel, who was a lawyer who used that phrase in one of his advertisements. And, you know, he was using it to try to sell his business, sell his services. And it got picked up. And this judge used it improperly in that ruling. That's where it came from. It all originated because, let me see here. I'm sure I got it written down here. So I'm looking for. Oh, here it is. Collie Lee Daniel is the person who started the frighteningly high lie. Let's see here. I don't have the judge's name. I think you mentioned the judge's name in the ruling you were reading. But he
Kennedy.
Picked, but yeah, he picked that up. But Daniel later retracted his statement, admitted that it was a lie, admitted that he made it up, but the damage is done. It got picked up, it got put into the mantra, and now you can't change it. I'm originally from Pennsylvania too, by the way, Ellie. I was looking for that PA Supreme Court case here. I know it's in this notebook somewhere. I think it was, I can't remember the name of the, I can't remember names. I'm terrible with names. But anyway, if I find it, I'll let you know. But I just wanted to mention that Collie Lee Daniel is the one that started that. He was a lawyer trying to drum up business. That's all it was. It was absolutely no science at all behind it. It was just something he pulled out of the air and used it to try to sell his business.
Well, thanks for that information. Frightening and high.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Thanks, Marty. I saw what you just put in the chat. Okay. So we are going on to the Halloween sign challenge that Janice won in the, it was an appeal from the U.S. District Court, and it was a man named Thomas Sanderson who challenged a Missouri statutory provision that required all registered sex offenders such as himself to post a sign on their residence on Halloween stating, "No candy or treats at this residence," concluding that this mandate violated the First Amendment. The District Court permanently enjoined its enforcement statewide. The defendant's appealed. The defendants lost. Janice won, and the U.S. attorney for that particular district is deciding whether or not to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. My guess is that the U.S. Supreme Court will not take this issue. It is what is called compelled speech, which is a violation of the First Amendment when the law said you have to put this sign up. That's compelled speech. And that was one of Janice's successes. This she argued September of last year, and this opinion was filed January 2nd of 2026. So that was a good win for registrants in that area. Here we have another win for those of you in California. It is John Doe versus the U.S. Department of Justice. And this was a case that Janice initially filed in the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California. And then the Pacific Legal Foundation came in as counsel. And there were initially four John Does. And the issue for most of them was that these John Does were relieved from registration in California due to the change of the law. But the federal SORNA Act required them to register. And it was an impossibility because when these individuals went to their police agency and said, I no longer have to register in California, but this federal law is making me register. And the police agency said, sorry, we're not going to register you. Go away. And so this was a lawsuit in that regard. And initially, there was a temporary injunction that Judge Bernal, and it was in the Riverside court. It was still district court, but it was in the Riverside district. Judge Bernal initially issued a temporary injunction, and this case went on forever. Some of you, I'm sure, remember how Janice would say, well, the next hearing is on such and such date, and it would get postponed. Well, on April 9th of this year, just Judge Bernal issued a ruling, and he issued a permanent injunction. And he dismissed the claims for two of the remaining three plaintiffs, but he issued a permanent injunction for the remaining one. And this is what it says. Having decided in plaintiff's favor on their due process claim, the court now fashions the appropriate relief. And there's a rule of civil procedure under federal law, and it sets forth the requirements for issuing an injunction. And in order to issue an injunction, the court must state the reasons why it issued, state its terms specifically, and describe in reasonable detail the acts restrained or required. So going back to the due process claim, in plain English, due process means fairness. And that's what the judge was determining, what is fair in this case. And what the Judge Bernal went on is that the court finds that the terms of the preliminary injunction are the proper terms of a permanent injunction. The federal government is enjoined from prosecuting any California resident for any violation of SORNA, the rule, or any other regulation without first abiding by the following requirement. First, in all such prosecutions, the federal government must seek and obtain certification from the state of California that the individual was required to register under California law. Two, in a prosecution concerning a failure to provide specific information required, the federal government must seek and obtain certification from the state of California that California law allows the individual to furnish that information to state authorities. So it is a permanent injunction for registrants in the state of California. So far, it does not apply to the other 49 states. Who knows what will happen? But one thing that Janice emphasized in the last meeting we had is both sides might appeal. And if they appeal, it goes to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. And the current person in the White House despises the Ninth Circuit. And the reason he despises the Ninth Circuit is that they follow the law and they tend to be more liberal than their counterparts. There have been some additions to the Ninth Circuit bench, which is kind of changing it. But the Ninth Circuit usually had a reputation of being more liberal than other circuits. So the other issue is that there was a case that came out, I believe, last year, and I want to say it's Trump versus CASA, which the Supreme Court, and this is the United States Supreme Court, said permanent injunctions to cover everybody are illegal. And so what Justice Bernal did is he put this permanent injunction for the entire state of California. That might be one issue of appeal as to whether it just applies to individuals who are in the United States District Court for the Central District of California. So anyway, that was a big win. And we'll see if it gets appealed. And if it does get appealed by either side, we'll post it on the Axol website. So that's John Doe versus the U.S. Department of Justice. And that was issued April 9th of 2026. So that means that people who were terminated from the registry in California do not have to comply with the federal SORNA regulations. All right. So there is a website called smart.gov, www.smart.gov. I don't know how smart it is, but it discusses different issues that are on the agenda.
Excuse me. I saw that Ron had his hand up again.
Oh, Pastor Ron, go ahead.
Okay, I think I'm on now. Am I on now?
Yes.
Okay. I found these that I wanted to follow up with you on. This came out of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. This was decided 19 July 2017, so not that long ago. Commonwealth versus Muniz, M-U-N-I-Z. It established that SORNA is punitive and that no ex post facto law shall be passed. That's Pennsylvania Constitution, Article 1, Section 17. So here the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that SORNA is punitive. In the Eastern District of Virginia, Landman versus Royster in 1971, quote, any treatment to which a prisoner is exposed is a form of punishment, unquote. As a result of being punishment, it is subject to an Eighth Amendment review. So if a prisoner, and while you are in custody, you are a prisoner, whether you are on the street or not. If you're on parole, you're still in custody under the law. So, you know, if you are registered, that is a form of punishment under that ruling, is it not?
Yes, and just to let everybody know, the Eighth Amendment is commonly referred to as the Cruel and Unusual mm-hmm. Punishment Amendment. And mm-hmm. let me give you an example in criminal terms. A juvenile in California sentenced to life without parole, that is considered cruel and unusual punishment. So yeah, when a juvenile is treated as an adult, usually for a murder, maybe with special circumstances, attorneys argue that it's cruel and unusual punishment to have a minor sentenced as an adult to life in prison without parole. The other way it comes into play in a criminal case involving a juvenile is if a juvenile is sentenced on a murder case and the judge imposes as an adult, the juvenile is treated as an adult, imposes a sentence of 100 years to life. That is considered functional life, and that is also not allowed under the Eighth Amendment because of the cruel and unusual punishment clause. So thank you, Pastor Ron, for those cases.
Well, here's the last one. This is the one I was looking for. It was all the way back on page 8. Excuse me. Justice Donnie, again, going back to Commonwealth, Pennsylvania. The opinion that she wrote on shaming and harassment, quote, without any mechanism to prove rehabilitation, even though the clearest proof is available. Worldwide dissemination of registrants' information now outweighs the public safety interest of the government so as to disallow a finding that it is merely regulatory. So here we're holding that up again. SORNA's registration scheme does not provide offenders with an opportunity to challenge their registration requirement by establishing to a fact finder that the offender has reformed and no longer poses a threat to the public. Thus, under SORNA, individuals convicted of sexually violent offenses are required to register without a determination regarding the offender's level of dangerousness and likelihood of reoffense ever being made. She emphasized the word ever. It goes back to the whole irrebuttable presumption doctrine. Judge Renee Cohn-Jubilier upheld the irrebuttable presumption clause, overruled the registration, and upheld the whole thing as a violation of due process. You know, Pennsylvania's whole Megan's Law has been thrown out, declared unconstitutional 5 times.
Right.
But no judge has had the guts to say, okay, that's it. It's done. We're going to throw it out. It's unconstitutional. We're done with it. No judge has had the guts to do that yet. They just say, go reword it so that, you know, it'll fit. Well, they did that 4 times and it's still not working.
Thank you for that information. Carl in Missouri.
Hey, Pastor Ron, if you don't mind, can you tell me the name of that case again or what you were just reading?
That was from several different cases. The one I didn't know if I hit my mute button. That first one was from a case in Pennsylvania called Perez. I give you the reference to it. It was 97A3rd, page 765-66. I didn't, for some reason, I didn't actually write the case number down, but it's Perez.
And Pastor Ron, would it be possible for you to paste links to that in the chat window?
Well, it's all in my notebook. I don't have it. Yeah, I don't have it on.
Can you type it? Would it be possible to type it in the chat window?
Yeah, sure. I can do that.
Thank you. That would say.
Okay, yeah. Sure. I'll be happy to do that.
All right.
Thank you.
So the next item I want to talk is federal incarceration, because some people have convictions out of federal courts. And this is what I found. It was a report July 2025, just last year. And it says, a separate federal registration program does not exist for sex offenders who are released from federal custody. However, certain federal government agencies, including the Bureau of Prisons, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of Homeland Security, are involved with sex offender registration and notification, and at least one agency, the Bureau of Prisons, is required to notify local law enforcement when sex offenders are released from federal correctional facilities. Additionally, these sex offenders are required to comply with SORNA's registration requirements as mandatory conditions of their federal supervision. Whenever a federal prisoner who is required to register under SORNA is released, the Board of Prisons is required to provide, prior to release, the sex offender's release and registration information to state, tribal, and local law enforcement and registration officials. The Board of Prisons is also required to notify prisoners of their registration responsibilities, and the Board of Prisons does not register sex offenders prior to their release from incarceration. So anyway, that is in regard to anybody with a federal conviction who served time in a federal facility. Another item they had in this document was international travel. And I know Janice discusses international travel at length. I'm not going to do that because I'm not an expert in that field. I can say, being half Italian, that you can go to Italy without a problem. So there you go. But there are a number of nations who will exclude anybody who's a registrant. But for international travel, what it says is sex offenders who intend to travel outside of the United States for any period of time must inform their residence jurisdiction at least 21 days in advance. And jurisdictions are then required to notify the U.S. Marshals Service and update the sex offenders registration information in the national databases regarding such travel. Implementation of this requirement varies by jurisdiction, and sex offenders' attempts to challenge this requirement on constitutional grounds have typically failed. Roger, you recently traveled to Europe. Was that your understanding or practice before you went?
For preparation, sorry, I was dealing with a problem. Are you asking about the documentation necessary and procedure?
And registering, well, letting your residence jurisdiction know 21 days in advance?
Yes, that was absolutely a requirement. I also found that the police departments have their own custom forms that they fill out and then feed that information into a standardized computer. So it may vary from office to office, but you absolutely do need to know them. And I do recommend that people do it way ahead of time, because if you miss it just by a few days, they can just cancel your whole trip. So be conservative on that and make sure that you have all of your documentation. You need the passport with your identifier if that's a requirement for your particular crime. I messed up and I almost missed my trip because of the timing on that. Allow plenty of time for a new passport. They can take a very long time. I'll post a link for our international travel that has a lot of these tips and a sample, for example, of the letter that you have to include with your passport with unique identifier request. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you, Roger, for adding that. Thank you. So I know that Janice has talked about this in the past, child custody, and I believe that she took on a case for a registrant who was being denied child custody because he was a registrant. And the same document from the Department of Justice says being required to register as a sex offender can also have an impact on an individual's parental rights, including child custody. In at least one state, and that's Delaware, there is a statutory presumption against any registered sex offender being granted unsupervised visitation, custody, or residential placement of a child. In another state, and that's Oklahoma, there is a rebuttable presumption that a parent is affirmatively unfit if they are or have been required to register as a sex offender. Well, let me give you some hope in regard to this. And this is a current case out of the 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. It's Henry versus the Sheriff of Tuscaloosa County, Alabama. And I'm going to read you part of the opinion, but it was vacated, so there is an en banc hearing. So what that means is that initially there were three justices from the 11th Circuit who heard the case and issued an opinion. And the respondents, which is the Sheriff of Tuscaloosa County, requested a hearing en banc, which means the entire panel of the 11th Circuit is going to hear the case and make a decision. And that will probably include like 11 or 13 justices. I'm not certain how many, but this was the initial opinion filed in 2025. Alabama code prohibits adult sex offenders who have been convicted of a sex offense involving a child from residing or conducting an overnight visit with a minor, including their own child. No exceptions. The plaintiff, Mr. Henry, pled guilty to one count of possessing child porn and challenges the law as applied to him. What the court goes on to say is that Henry has completed his term of imprisonment, married, and fathered a son, but the law doesn't allow Henry to live with his son. Henry asserts that the law violates his First Amendment right of intimate association and the 14th Amendment's guarantees of equal protection of the laws and due process. Remember, due process is fairness. In particular, he argues that the law interferes with perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests that the 14th Amendment secures, the fundamental right of a parent to make decisions concerning the care, custody, and control of their children. We agree. To be sure, Alabama has a compelling reason for its law to protect children, and certainly some sex offenders should never have the chance to be near children, including their own. But that court found in favor of Mr. Henry that the law was overbroad, and so we just have to wait to see what the entire 11th Circuit is going to decide, and we'll keep you posted on that. But I know that Janice has run into individuals who have been denied reunification with their child because of that 290 offense. And my suggestion is that anybody who finds himself in that situation to contact Janice. And this would probably be in the state of California. But anyway, good for that 11th Circuit in Alabama. Now we go to a housing issue. And what this same document the Department of Justice wrote about housing is that sex offenders who are subject to a lifetime registration requirement under state or federal law are generally prohibited from admission to federally assisted housing. And that would be like Section 8. Some jurisdictions also prohibit sex offenders from living in campus student housing at a public institution of higher learning. So the key ruling is lifetime registration. In California, there's tiers. There's Tier 1 and Tier 2. We'll get into that later. And I looked up the HUD regulations, mandatory prohibition for lifetime sex offenders. And these HUD regulations, and if anybody wants the law, contact me, I'll give it to them, but prohibit admission after June 25th, 2001, if any member of a household is subject to a state lifetime sex offender registration requirement. This regulation reflects a statutory prohibition. A household receiving assistance with such a member is receiving assistance in violation of federal law. So it's the key word is lifetime registration. Not 10-year registration, not 20-year registration, not 5-year registration. It is lifetime. So that is the key. All right. So going on, I tried to find data for how many people register in the United States. And the only thing I could find was from August of 2024. And in the United States, it says more than 795,000 people were listed on state sex offender registries as of August 2024. This is about 8,000 more individuals than 8,000 more people than in 2023. So that number went up. But in California, I went to the CAISOM meeting, their board meeting in March, and CAISOM is California Sex Offender Management Board, and the board is compiled of district attorneys, parole officers, probation officers, judges, psychologists, people in charge of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And as of March of 2026, there was a little over 104,000 people on the registry in California. So there was discussion at that CAISOM meeting is why people who are eligible to be removed from the registry aren't doing it in California. And they suggested maybe it's because they're not on the Megan's Law list, or maybe it's because they don't find it a problem. But we're going to talk about the tiered registry pretty soon. And so that's the data. Now, the last meeting, we talked about AB 1568. It is an assembly bill 1568 in California. And Janice and I and a number of other individuals who are in this meeting or on the board of the Family Safety Foundation or the Axol board, we went and commented against it in early March when it was in the Public Safety Committee. And what this AB 1568 wants to do is to tweak the registration law in California and require everybody to undergo a treatment program that is approved by KSOM, even though KSOM didn't start approving programs until 2011. So that means somebody who's a 20-year registrant in Tier 2 might not have been able to take such a program. Well, on May 14, it was in the Appropriations Committee, and unfortunately, it was amended and passed. So it was in the suspense file for the longest time, from April 8 to May 14. And so it passed in the Appropriations Committee. I do not know what the next step is, but that is a bad law. The 290 Registration Act to terminate registration in California was given a lot of thought. Jackie Lacey, a former district attorney in Los Angeles County, championed it. And now somebody wants to tweak it. So we will keep you updated on AB 1568. Let's talk about the California tiered registration law. So I believe in 2018, the law was passed, but it did not take effect until 2021. Why? Who knows? But it took a while before people could start getting off the registry. And the new registration law in California creates that tiers. There's three. There's Tier 1, and a Tier 1 person is required to register for 10 years. Tier 2, the person is required to register for 20 years. And Tier 3 is lifetime registration. And reasons for this change is because law enforcement found that the registration was too bulky with individuals who did not need law enforcement supervision. And it allows the law enforcement to supervise those in Tier 3 who are lifetime registrants. So if somebody in California wants to terminate their registration, if they're in Tier 1 or Tier 2, the procedure is that they have to get a form from their the agency where they register called proof of current registration. And for those of you in California, if you have not received your tier designation, get it. Law enforcement has it. It's done by the Department of Justice. And for those of you, if you have out-of-state convictions and you move to California, the Department of Justice then designates your tier by looking to see what the law was in the state where you were convicted. Sometimes they don't get it right. And if you think your designation is incorrect, contact Janice, because I think she's done that type of work before. So there are forms on the web. And when the forms are completed, oh, I'm getting a message that my internet is unstable. Anyway, I hope I'm still going strong. But anyway, if you get,
are. If, oh, if you get, if it gets to be broken, you can turn off your video, and that way your audio will remain clear.
Okay.
If it starts having problems.
Okay. So for somebody who wants to terminate registration, let's say they're in Tier 1, it's 10-year registration, and they have the sufficient time and they're eligible. The petition needs to be served on the law enforcement agency where the individual registers, and the law enforcement agency that did the initial arrest if it's different. It also gets served to the district attorney in the district where registration occurs, and the district attorney where the registration was initiated if it's different. And then law enforcement determines by running the person's rap sheet whether or not the person is eligible. My first client, and I probably told this story before, my first client was convicted in 1970 for skinny dipping in a motel pool. And he subsequently went to prison on a kidnap for carjacking. So he served another chunk of time. And so the law enforcement needed extra time to go through his rap sheet and see if he had the requisite time, which he did. So also, this is an aside, this is like a left turn. In California, everybody can get their own rap sheet. So you can see what's on your your rap sheet in California, you just go to the California Department of Justice website, and it's real easy. You click on the criminal history, find my criminal history. It is very interesting. You just click from one to another, and you can order your own rap sheet. The new term is live scan. There's a form you can fill out. You fill out that form. The Department of Justice fee is about $25, and the live scan fee is anywhere from $30 to $50. So everybody can get their own live scan and see what is on their rap sheet in California. Unfortunately, I do not know about other states. I do know for somebody to get their federal rap sheet, you have to send an actual inked fingerprints. So you've got to find somebody who does inked prints and you send it in. And I'll tell you, I have seen federal rap sheets and they're really hard to read. But anyway, in California, if you're interested, get your own rap sheet so you know what's on. Timothy, you have a question. Timothy, can you unmute Timothy?
Thank you. Yes. So I am a registered sex offender, and I was arrested in July 2023, and I still don't have my TIR, as far as I know. Last time I did my local police station around my birthday, you know, to redo my thing, and I'm still on probation right now. They still don't have my TIR. Is there a way to find out my TIR, or is it just because of California or the so forth, being behind and so forth?
Were you convicted in California?
Yes, and I've served my jail sentence as well. So you know, all those things have been finalized, but I'm still waiting to hear from to get my actual TIR. It's supposed to be a 3, but there's a possibility maybe lowering it. I don't know.
You could probably contact Janice. She's on vacation, so give her a couple of weeks. Okay. And send her an email. Mm-hmm. And she may be able to help you, but that's a really long time not to have a TIR designation.
Yeah, and I think I had heard, because I've never been able to join the group live, but I've listened to the previous recordings, and I always thought it was around 2 years or something like that, that they had to do it by the state of California, but I could have heard that wrong. I don't recall correctly, you know. So, but yeah, if it sounds like you a long period of time, then I'll definitely reach out to her.
I think initially it was the Department of Justice wanted time, and they want time if it's an out of state or federal conviction. But yours is in California, and it's just ridiculous that they have not.
Yeah, because I'm coming up to that. 3 years now since my arrest, but. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mark, you have a question. Mark, unmute. Mark, yoo-hoo. Mark, there you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I was trying to unmute. Anyway, my name is Mark. I did 15 years on supervision. I recently got off in December of 25, and I was so looking forward to traveling. And then I found you guys and learned all this information. Brutal, as always, the whole process from 2006. But anyway, I'm going to Europe. I'm going to a yoga retreat in Sardinia in the fall. I already sent my passport in to get that designation. But I just want to say, like, the lack of communication between whatever and whoever. I sent my passport in. They sent it back with a letter stating I needed to get the designation. 2 days later, I got my passport in the mail, or like a couple weeks later, even before that, with a designation on it. You know what I mean? So
yes.
It just seems like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. I'm currently, to give people hope, I would go to your local public defender's office. There's a program here. I live in San Francisco, which, you know, of course is a blessing, but I went to this the public defender. They have a program called Clean Slate, and so I have an attorney looking into my designation to try to see if she's an attorney, she's going to try to get it lowered anyway, because I'm tier 3 for even, like, it's beyond. I mean, I could go on forever, but anyway, that's just all I wanted to share. Thanks for all you're doing. Thanks all you guys. You know, it's just a blessing to have you, and, you know, just keep on keeping on no matter what. The guy who just talked to you just got out, man. You just got to keep on keeping on. Be a light in the world no matter what. Be positive and just hope for the best, because this is ridiculous what we have to live with. Thank you.
Right. And you said you had 15-year parole, and I know there are some laws, and some people have a 10-year parole in California for certain offenses, and some people have a 20-year parole. And I know I've been contacted by people saying, you know, I have a 10-year parole. Can I get off? off. And I need to investigate that a little more, because to me, that's just an onerous condition of, you know, a 10-year parole and a 20-year parole in California.
Really quick, mine was actually 10 years, but I violated, I was in the Eastern District in Bakersfield when I was released, and it was hell on earth. The probation officers were totally different, mean, unsupportive. Anyway, I have a lot of passion for life. I started doing men's physique shows. I did steroids. She violated me twice for steroids, extended my probation 8 years, but I just got released early based on that here, though. So really, I was supposed to get off in two, because they extended it. And it's the same story. You take a plea, even though I had the best supposed attorney ever that they gave me. And then, you know, after a year in court, they say, oh, just take the plea, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. You know, after you waste your life savings on the original case on an attorney who said, this is a gray area, you're going to get off, all the bullshit of the whole program. But anyway, that was why I got off. It was 15 years. It should have been 17, but because of the violations. So, but in San Francisco, the POs, everybody here said, we would never have violated you for that. We'd have just said, Mark, come on, you can't do that. Stop doing that. And whatever, you know, then I would just go on my way. But this was the Eastern District, Bakersfield, hell on earth. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Paul Roberts. Paul, unmute. Paul?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
Okay. I have actually three questions. Is Janice doing anything on the ankle monitors or the lie detector tests that are part of the rehabilitation group? Because I had a situation where my monitor pinged like a half a mile away, and a substitute PO called and said, how come you were over here? And I told her I wasn't. And I couldn't have been in the place that pinged on the monitor. So when I was in the parole office itself, they showed me that and told me that these things are not accurate. And it pinged me about a quarter of a mile away while I was sitting in the parole agent's office right there. And then as far as the lie detector test, the National Academy of Science made a report that says that the lie detector test, the polygraphs, are no better than flipping a coin. And the National Academy of Science is pretty reputable, you know, agency. And so now I have Sharper Future that has told me, you're done with treatment. You've done everything that you need to do. And I had a containment meeting about 4 days ago, and they're not taking me out, the CDCR is not taking me out of treatment. And so now my clinician at Sharper Future is angry and is saying, okay, the only thing we can do is put you on maintenance and just have you come in once a month. When I went to the containment meeting, they told me to continue with treatment. And so I'm going to be filing a 602 because it's only been 4 days. But it's just confusing to me that they're relying on so much junk science, even within the Department of Corrections, because none of this is any good. I mean, it's just, it's crazy.
Let me address the ankle monitor. I believe the ankle monitor is a Department of Corrections, Bureau of Parole regulation. I don't think it has anything to do with the treatment program.
I think you're right.
And I've had clients, like I was working with one guy who, he picked up a registrable offense when he was a minor, when there was still a California Youth Authority. And then he picked up a 187 as an adult. And he had to wear a monitor, even though his commitment offense, the most recent one he was on parole for, was not a registrable offense. It was in the past. Treatment programs are allowed to give polygraphs? Personally, I think it's a sin because it is junk science. It's not allowed to be introduced in court, in a court proceeding. And in regard to the containment meeting, and I think that's one of the issues that Janice is, has, you know, refiled a lawsuit against Department of Corrections because they're not following the regulations they agreed to in regard to treatment. So keep us posted in regard to that, because I think that's one of Janice's pending lawsuits.
Yeah, because my original registered offense was 45 years ago. And so I did a 25 to life sentence on a regulatory offense, failure to register. And I recently got about a year and a half ago, and I'm in treatment, and I'm so far above anybody that's there because of all the treatment that I had on the inside and through the last 45 years. But it just seems ridiculous.
You did 25 years to life on a failure to register?
Yes, ma'am. In fact, it wasn't even a failure to a register. I did a 25 years to life on a failure to notify authorities when leaving the state. I was actually registered in the state of California. I left the state, and when they picked me up in Montana, one charge, only leaving the state without notifying the authorities, I did a 25 to life sentence on.
And you did that in California or Montana?
Yes, ma'am. Nope, I did it in California.
Holy crap. So you had strike?
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Too bad the Prop 36, which amended the strike law, didn't help you to get out earlier, but I digress. But thanks for sharing.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Dan, you're next.
Yes. Hi there. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. A couple of things for the last two people that spoke. I just got off technically yesterday. It was supposed to be Monday, but there was some kind of a problem with Interstate Compact, and so it kept dragging on and on. I finally had to call Interstate Compact and say, hey, what the hell's going on? And so I had my PO call them, and they straightened it out. So I finally got off yesterday. And the reason I'm bringing this up is mine was a 15 year term, and so I ended up getting off in 10 with a 10 and 2 months. And
in California,
I'm Interstate Compact from Arizona, and I live in California, so I'm here in California
Now. Okay,
which is more difficult. You know, having to fight Arizona is crazy because they never let people off early, never. But I got an attorney. It cost me $5,000, and it was successful. So there is hope. You can get off early. Of course, it depends on a lot of circumstances. Now, in my case, technically, if you look at my record, I had three violations, but they were all BS stuff. The first one, I got the first two when I just was released. One was something with charging, and another one was I was doing some work, and they the job site decided to have our lunch and whatnot on a school ground, and so I let my PO know, and he still violated me. And then the third one has to do with Sharper Future, where this goes to the second person who was talking. They really screwed me over in so many ways; it's unbelievable. But I was trying to, they're only supposed to have you for 1 to 2 years. They had me on for 9. And so I finally was petitioning to, working with them to get out of that stupid program. And I finally did, but they dragged it out for like 3 months. I was just waiting for them to do the paperwork, And so in that time I had work, and so I missed a day. And even though I had technically completed the program, a temporary PO violated. So that violation caused me to have to postpone my, trying to get off early, because I should have been off last year. But because of now I had the violation, I told my attorney, I says, there's no way I'm to go before the judge with a violation, a fresh violation. That's ludicrous. So we paused for a whole year. I finally, after the year, I went to my PO and said, listen, can you guys give me like a clean bill of health? And so he finally did. I got a good PO, and he gave me a copy of the paperwork, and I gave it to my attorney, and he took it before the judge, and I'm out, off now. So I'm hoping that this information will help you all.
Thank you, Dan.
Sure.
All right, thanks for sharing. Chana, am I saying your name right? Chana?
Yeah, it's actually Shauna. But I respond to Chana also.
Chana.
Hello, everyone. I guess I just wanted to see if our situation was similar to many others, or if the stories are just wide and a wide net out there. But my son in 2023 had applied to the police department. He had a little family, and he was trying to make ends meet. They go through a personal history questionnaire. There was a question on there that stated, had you ever been with anybody under the age of 17 when you were over the age of 17. At the time, his father-in-law was also a sergeant with the police department, and he gives him the advice and says, well, you answer yes, because my son, at that time he was 26, he remembered an occasion back when he first left home, which was about 19 years old, and he met a girl on Tinder, and she did not Obviously, she lied about her age, and he found out later. So, you know, the father-in-law then fast forward to when he's 26, says, "Oh, you answer yes. You know, you can explain these things away. What do you think they're going to do? You think they're going to bust in and arrest you?" Well, the gentleman that did his one-on-one interview turned that interview into an interrogation, unbeknownst to my son, and furthermore said, "Hey, give me the name of and the city that that young lady lives in." My son ignorantly does that. And about 3 months later, they come into my son was working with social work at the hospital, and they went into his place of employment and arrested him for aggravated sexual assault. Now, as we went through that whole trial, pre-trial and everything, he had taken a plea for 8 years probation and post tenure for the registry, which is unfortunate. I mean, my family, we hired a $50,000 attorney, and it's now we just know that there's no way to tell one good attorney from the other. It doesn't even matter how much we're charged. As he's walking through the probation system, you mentioned the polygraph. He's taken two so far. The first one was inconclusive, and he was completely treated as though he failed that one, even though it was an inconclusive result. The second one, he passed it, but beforehand it's really just a tool for the probation office, because they said, "Hey, why don't you just say what what you need to get off of your chest? I'd really like you to pass this test." And so he admitted to going to lunch with another felon, another registrant, and so that was a violation of probation. And so now he is going to the punishment for that is 14 days in jail, but he'll be allowed to continue probation. The story
what is your question or your comment that, because somebody made a comment that we don't want too much information because this is being recorded, but what do you have a question or an issue that you want to
sounds
horrible.
Yeah, does it sound like a similar story, like a common story in these circles, or are these stories just a wide net that you throw out there? I guess the other question too is, because with probation, I did try to help him and request ADA accommodation. They didn't know how to treat that. I mean, after the whole situation, the his mental, his recall, his memory was just shot. And I feel like we get a lot of retaliation for that, especially because of this little lunch that he had. From the word go, it was like, okay, it was like they were doing us a favor. We're going to give you 14 days in jail, and then you can come back to probation. It's such an injustice. I understand why everybody is talking about the laws. Nobody is listening. I've met with my congressman. I mean, he latches on for a little while and then obviously pushes me off to the side. I'm getting ready to walk to the state capitol and have media attention that way to get some eyes on some of the issues that we're dealing with.
You have a number of issues, and what a nightmare. Your son wanted to go in law enforcement, and he ended up being on the wrong side of the law for something that was completely innocent.
The charging horrible. Officer was actually arrested and left the force for domestic violence. The prosecuting attorney she's facing disciplinary sanctions on her practice also. So it's a really awful system here. I don't know if that's a familiar story to everyone or if anybody can relate to this.
Well, I think we all can relate because, we're here, every month to talk about trying to change, laws and understanding what laws are there. I'm not sure if we can do anything for you now other than, listening. And, it's a horrible, what you described just sounded like it's a nightmare still going on. And You know, I don't know if this is your first meeting here, but we hope you come back and find the support. And as Marty said earlier in the meeting, there's that emotional support group. It sounds like that might be a good idea for you and your son. But that just sounds, you know, like a path. Your son was on a path to do law enforcement, you know, noble work. And, you know, it was a nightmare that you're living. And I'm sorry to hear it.
I'm sorry to turn the water hose on anybody. Yeah. It is refreshing to find a group where I could learn about the law. So I appreciate the moment to speak.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. Pastor Ron, you're next up.
Yeah, I put a rather lengthy thing. Y'all had asked me to put all of that stuff in the chat, so I did. It was kind of a lengthy list of information there. One thing I wanted to share, because it is so crucial to what we're discussing here today, was the last thing I posted. It was quite long. I think it was about 6 or 7 or maybe 8 different panels. And this all came from Jones versus Cunningham in the United States Supreme Court in 1963. And it was upheld in 1973. In applying this understanding, the court followed the common law tradition that recognized liberty restraints to encompass both physical imprisonment and substantial oversight by the state or a private party. Well, I don't know about you, but I think this whole registry scheme certainly qualifies as substantial oversight. It tells you where you can go, where you can't go, where you can sleep, where you can eat, where you can stand up, where you can sit down, where you can take a dump, where you can look, where you can't look. You know, it tells you everything you can and can't do. If it's not substantial oversight, I don't know what is. So how can it be anything but custodial? How can it be anything but punishment?
And that's why we're here.
Right. Yeah. So I just want to throw this stuff out there because, I mean, these are court decisions. That came from the Supreme Court, for crying out loud. Yeah. And I have one question regarding something that was posted in the chat. Someone posted that the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that polygraph testing is unconstitutional. When was that? And has that ever been challenged? Because I'd never heard that decision.
That was me that posted that, Dean. And
you there, Dean?
Yes. Did you hear me?
Yes. What year was that?
I'll have to look it up. I have it.
Okay. You can post it in the chat. Let's go on to Eric. Eric, you've been waiting patiently.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's up?
I have a simple question. I was convicted in 1996. The registration in Florida came out in 1997. And in 2002, I got a notice to where I had to register. Since then, I've been to prison a couple times for failure to register in Chicago. And I just got picked up for a failure to register, which I have all my documentation. I have a court appearance on the 26th. I'm hoping
that state. What state?
The toughest state of all.
Oh yeah, God. They have dead people on the registration.
Yeah, it's Palm Beach County. But anyway, the prosecutors offered me two years of an ankle monitor on house arrest, and I'm not going to take it to trial. My question is how can they the retroactive law of in all the states, how can they get around that and legally to get that law abolished?
It's called, Eric, the term, the legal term is called ex post facto. Three words, ex post facto. And they do an analysis and they determine that it's fine. That was one of the big issues in Smith versus Doe, that the ex post facto for people who registered in Alaska was okay, even though their offense occurred way before the registration law was enacted. So I don't think anybody is ready to take that to court again. But if they do, we'll let you know.
Right. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
All right. Aaron, what's up? Aaron with two N's.
Yes. Thank you so much. And my husband, James, is here. He's on the registry. He was arrested in California, and now he's off parole here with me in New Mexico. But we kept, and I don't know if you guys want these. He was in the HOPE program. Have you heard of the HOPE program? So we have all of his homework assignments, like the questions that they asked him, which were shocking, humiliating, infuriating, 2 years of it. I can't believe these people consider themselves therapists. And I don't know, like, if that would be valuable to send these to you.
Hey, why not? Where's Roger? If you could send Aaron Janice's email, actually, I'd like to see him too. That might help too. I know when Janice filed these lawsuits, there's a term called discovery. And what it means is that she's allowed to ask for certain records from the Department of Corrections. But if you have them, we'd be glad to look over them.
Okay.
Maybe discuss it at the next meeting.
Okay. And we almost shredded them all and I said, wait a second, let's try to give them to you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. A couple of things, because we got like a half hour. I thought we'd be done by now, but you guys have been great with your questions and comments. One thing I wanted to talk about is Janice brought these up. There's two bills pending in Congress. There's H.R. 7453, and it is to amend the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 to make sex offenders ineligible for the refundable credit for coverage under a qualified health plan, and to amend Title 19 of the Social Security Act to make sex offenders ineligible for federally funded medical assistance under the Medicaid program. We think that sucks. And but when I looked it up, and I don't know if this is AI or not, so take this with a grain of salt. It says this bill has a 2% chance of getting past committee and a 1% chance of getting enacted. And so, you know, to make health care unavailable for somebody who's a registrant makes no sense, because we all know that people without health care, the bills are going to be higher by going to the emergency room trying to get, you know, health care that way. The other John Beasley, you have a hand up. John?
Yes, ma'am. So it was in regards to what the said before about like the process with the humiliation with the treatment or whatever. I ended up burning my book from my treatment program just because a cleansing process. But in the sex offense treatment program here in Utah, the whole I guess program that they require is very much based, you know, similarly around shaming and very generalized, and the questions they ask you and stuff are, you know, up to the point of, you know, do you have interest in having sex with dead people and things like those, and they make everybody, no matter what your charge is, go through all of these things and just kind of write assignments and different things along those lines. That's just it's very based around everybody is a, you know, an offender, you know, admit that you're you know, a deviant, no matter what your charge is and no matter your personal situation.
John, we plan to do that as soon as I scan them in, believe me. I love that. Burning it.
Yeah. I deleted all of the assignments off my drive and burned the book, and as a big cleansing of finally being done with the process. But
it was probably very cathartic, and so I completely understand why you'd burn it.
Yeah, otherwise I'd share it. But
right. Okay. Thank you. One other bill that was in Congress is H.R. 7624, and this is to prohibit certain sex offenders from entering or using the services of certain domestic and homeless shelters and for other purposes. In general, a covered shelter may not provide any service or shelter to a covered sex offender. And failure to comply, this is a kicker, a covered shelter that fails to comply with requirement under paragraph 1 shall be ineligible to receive any federal funds during the following fiscal year. So H.R. 7624 is not going to only punish registrants, but it will also punish the agency that shelters them. And again, you know, what I found is that there's a 5% chance of getting past committee and a 2% chance of being enacted. What I also found in regard to these bills is that only 11% of bills made it past committee and only about 2% were enacted in 2021 to 2023. So that gives us some hope. So it's H.R. 7453 about no Medicaid and 7624, which is no shelter. So there you go. If you want to contact your congressperson. One thing I want to talk about is the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures. And when somebody is on probation or parole, there is usually a condition of probation or parole that the person must be subject to search or seizure at any time of the day or night. So basically, when somebody's on probation or parole, they do not have the Fourth Amendment protection. But when you're off probation or parole, and even though you might be a registrant, you have a Fourth Amendment right from unreasonable searches or seizures. So if law enforcement, if you're not on probation or parole and law enforcement comes knocking on your door, you don't have to let them in. That's your right. And I know Janice has talked about this in the past, but a lot of times law enforcement does compliance checks, and the compliance checks is that they want to make sure the person is living where he or she says they are living. You still have that Fourth Amendment right from unreasonable searches or seizures if you're not on probation or parole. So you do not have to let them inside, and you don't have to answer their questions either. You know, going back to the law, you know, if you are in custody and if the officer asks you a question that is designed to elicit an incriminating response, you don't have to answer it. You can ask for a lawyer. So these are just some basic tenets of the law that I want everybody to be aware of. And one other thing I want everybody to be aware of is you have a right to vote. If you're not serving a sentence, you have a right to vote. And whether you're in California or New York or Texas or Maine, you can vote. And this year, the elections are critical. California has an election for the governor, and right now it's a toss-up. There's been a lot of litigation about redistricting. But anyway, if you're not serving a sentence and you're just on probation or parole or whatever, you have a right to vote. And I hope everybody in this meeting exercises their right to vote. I don't know when the deadline is for voting, but this is a critical year. So get out and do your civic duty. John, you have another question? Yo, John. Yeah, now I can. What's okay. up?
So my question is, I did see in looking through the international stuff with kind of the whole, I guess you were saying when you're not on probation, they can't, you know, like search and any of that stuff. But when it comes to coming back from a country, that different, like, because I saw in there that you need to let them look through your phone if they want or look at pictures.
Yeah, that's different. That's coming through customs. And they could do that because you're coming through customs. And whether they check somebody with that designation on their passport, they might check it differently. You know, one thing you could do is not take your cell phone and then buy a burner phone when you're overseas. I don't know if that's possible.
Question on that. So when it comes to like immigration interviews, for example, with USCIS, with my wife, is it the same thing that can they look through my stuff or is that still protected?
Can you elaborate a little more coming through immigration?
So we're working on a change of status for my wife to going through the Adam Walsh waiver and everything, and we're going to have to do interviews. So my question is, do they have the right to go through my phone to check conversations or things like that, to see things like that, or is that protected?
You know, that's a good question. I you know, I have a gut feeling, but I'm not certain, so I don't want to say anything. If you have an immigration lawyer, I would say check with the immigration lawyer. That's
okay,
a good question.
I just figured with it being SO related that it might be, I don't know, cause it to be somewhat different.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to that question, but that's actually quite an interesting one that I'm going to have to go and ask immigration lawyers that I know.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That would be helpful. If I put my information earlier, I could put it again. If you find an answer to that, I'd love to hear.
Okay. All right. I'll try.
Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Eric.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, just to reiterate on what you just said about the voter registration, I wasn't even aware that I was able to vote because I hadn't registered since 1996 when I completed my sentence. And like I said, with the failure to register, it's just been hindering me. But when you brought up that you said we can't vote. I went and looked at my form from when I went and got my license renewed, and it said up underneath it a voter status. I am currently registered to vote. Is that an error, or am I able to vote? And this was just like a month ago when I received my receipt to my renewal of my driver's license.
Are you in Florida?
I'm in Florida, and I read the law.
I would check because I know from when I go to the Secretary of State's website, you know, as long as you're not serving a sentence, I think having a pending case doesn't matter. But if you're actually serving time for a felony, either in federal or a state prison, it might make a difference that you can't. So I would just go, and you can probably find something on the website for the state of Florida.
Well, I read into it, and it says for registrants they're not allowed to vote. So I'm going to be seeing my attorney on Monday anyway. I'm going to show before I present it to the prosecutor. Right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Several years ago in California, it used to be law that felons were not allowed to serve on a jury, and now in California, felons except a few people, including registrants, cannot serve on a jury. So if you are in California and you get notice that you have to go for jury duty, you might be able to get out if you're a registrant. One thing, I know we're short on time, but I just wanted to talk about the relief in California that's available for registrants. There are expungements in California, and it does exclude certain people on the registry. And so if you wanted an expungement in California, you could contact a nonprofit, or you could contact the public defender's office to see if your conviction is excluded. I know that there's a new law, relatively new law, about 3 years old in California. If somebody went to state prison, they can expunge their conviction, but it excludes people who are registrants. In California, there are certain crimes called wobblers, and they wobble between a felony and a misdemeanor. For example, receiving stolen property is a wobbler. It could be charged as a felony or a misdemeanor. Joyriding, temporarily taking a car, is a wobbler, either as a misdemeanor or felony. If somebody got probation on a registrable offense that's a wobbler, see if it can get reduced. You'd have to go to court, file a motion. You probably would want a lawyer to do this and get it reduced to a misdemeanor, because that does change. It could change the tier that you're in. There was a case, People versus Manzor, and Mr. Manzor was convicted of a 288.2. He was placed in tier 3 and got probation. He then had his felony reduced to a misdemeanor. And as a misdemeanor, he did not have to register, but he still went and applied, and the court said, sorry, you're still in tier 3 and you still have to register for life. Fortunately, there's now a case pending in the California appellate court, People versus Trout Castro. Some of you may have heard Janice talk about this in the past. Mr. Trout Castro had his felony reduced to a misdemeanor, and it was an offense for which the misdemeanor did require registration, but in tier 1. And the trial court judge says, sorry, I'm following Manzor, you're still in tier 3. And the attorney general conceded that because he went into a different tier, he can get his registration terminated. And the difference is Manzor, his offense was reduced, but was an offense that required no registration. And Trout Castro, when he had his felony reduced to a misdemeanor, he still was on the registry, but he got placed in tier 1. So that is kind of a technical issue. And if anybody is in California with a wobbler, seek out an attorney. If you go to prison on a wobbler, sorry, it's always going to be a felony and it can't be reduced to a misdemeanor. But with probation on a wobbler, ask a lawyer. Dan, you have your hand up.
Yes, hi there. Quick question. So on what you just said, is it possible that if somebody is removed from the registry after that happens, could that possibly make them eligible for expungement when before they were not?
As long as it's not a violation that's in the expungement law, if the person got removed from the registry, my guess is either tier one or tier two. And you can still go back to court if it's a wobbler and see if it can be reduced to a misdemeanor. But that's a technical question. And so a lawyer would need to know exactly what the conviction was for. Is it a wobbler? Is it in the expungement code as being ineligible? So, you know, it's not an easy question to answer. So you can contact me or Janice offline. You have our website.
Thank you.
You have our email. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.
So anyway, all right. Hold on. JB, thank you for those kind words. I had big shoes to fill for this meeting. Let's see. One thing that I wanted to mention is that if somebody went to prison in California, they would be eligible for a certificate of rehabilitation. So there's time limits that somebody has to pass in order to get a certificate of rehabilitation. I know somebody who, I think it was 10 years before he could apply, the trial court said no, but he ended up appealing and the appellate court said, yes, you can get the certificate of rehabilitation. So I know there's other people in other states here on this meeting. I don't know all of the laws in regard to expungements in other states, but I do know California and the relief that's available. So if you think you're eligible, you can always contact me. But any other questions before we close the meeting? It's been a great meeting. I've been honored to discuss everything with everybody today. Don't forget the in-person meeting on June 2nd in Pasadena.
June 6th, actually.
I thought it was June 2nd.
That's a Tuesday, I believe.
Oh, the meeting's a Saturday.
Yeah.
Oh, am I? Because I have to pick up the key for the building.
The June 2nd is Tuesday, June 6th. This is Saturday. I put the link in the chat.
Oh, good. It's June 6th. I'm sorry, everybody. Anybody who can go to the meeting, show up on Saturday, June 6th. My bad. I also want to say that Joe,
will there not be an online Zoom meeting then in June?
Oh, yes, there still will be. Third Saturday.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Oh, no.
Just so you guys know, the Zoom meetings are meant as informational intensive. As you can see, we covered a lot of stuff here, a lot of good stuff. The in-persons are like meet and greet, so you get to know the people, right? Maybe new people. So it's a different emphasis, and that's why we still have Zoom meetings every month. So Ellie is correct.
Yes. Well, I'm up against the other ocean, so it's a little far for me.
So the next Zoom meeting will be June 20. It's a Saturday, and I have the calendar, and the next in-person is in Pasadena. Janice will be there. There will be light snacks. And I just want to recognize Joe from the Family Safety Foundation. Joe is here with us. So thank you, Joe, for attending. And anyone with legal questions about wobblers can contact me. My email is sparkaroonie@yahoo.com, and Sparky was my dog, and it morphed into Sparkaroonie. One thing about me is that the dogs I have now are rescues, and I just rescued a little blind chihuahua who was dumped on the street, about 9 or 10 years old, according to the vet. And so in my spare time, that's what I do, is take care of my rescue dogs and two rescue cats. Anyway, so thank you, everyone, for attending. It's 11:56. I thought we'd be done earlier, but everybody had good questions. And thank you all. And hopefully we'll see some of you. Oh, Pastor Ron, you have 12 cats. Good for you. Anyway, we'll see you some on June 6th, if not June 20. Have a great weekend.